This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Plymouth author Matthew Cheney's debut collection of stories, Blood, contains some of the most disturbing fiction I've read in a long time. Picture a future in which people sell their bodies to companies that can harvest renewable energy from them, or a past where vulnerable men are severely beaten for the amusement of others. Imagine if you could hear the dead speaking through an old record player. These scenarios make up just some of the worlds created with vivid and creepy detail in Cheney's fiction, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And I should mention that this collection won the Hudson Prize from your publisher, Black Lawrence.
It did indeed.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
These characters in your stories are often just normal people who come across some kind of extraordinary circumstance, and one of my favorite examples of this is in the story Lonesome Road. That's the story where I'll just briefly summarize for our listeners. Shelley, she loses her son in the war, and she loses her husband because her husband can't stand her grief. So she moves in with her mother, and across the street there's this guy named Rick, and he's got an old Victrola who can allow you to listen to the dead calling out to the living. Fascinating story from beginning to end. Tell me, what was your inspiration for this one?
I think it goes back to my fascination with recorded music. There, one of the things I noticed putting the book together is there are a lot of record players and Victrolas in it, which is not by design at all. It's just something that's always interested me. I like really old American music, early recordings, and it feels like listening to the voices of the past. And I was thinking about some of my friends who I had grown up with, gone to elementary school with, who didn't make it through the Iraq War, or who were wounded in the Iraq War. And I was thinking about their parents, you know, because these were people of my parents' age, and wondered how they carried on, because it seems to me one of the really great losses in life is losing a child. Children should outlive their parents. And I don't know how people carry that weight and that burden. And so when I don't know something, particularly something emotional, I try to work it out through fiction. And this was one way to do that. And instead of just writing a straightforward story about grief, I came back to the questions of recorded voices. What are these voices? And what do they do to us? And what would it be to really, really want to hear a voice you had lost and to be given the opportunity to do so? Would you take that opportunity?
Some of your stories occur in sort of the shadow of some kind of apocalypse or a world where the world that we know doesn't exist anymore, and there's a new arrangement, a new social arrangement, a new governmental arrangement. And I wanted to ask you, what appeals to you about this kind of fiction?
I think the idea of your world suddenly changing, and one day everything is normal and the next day everything is different, is both a terror I sort of have. We've all experienced it at moments of heightened emotion. If somebody close to you dies or something, you lose your job or something like that, your world changes very, very suddenly. It's not what it was the day before. And I'm always drawn to that kind of emotion, that way of thinking through a story, because it gives a story a kind of propulsion. I'm also always sort of worried about the future. And I think that if you worry about the future a lot, then apocalyptic scenarios are really appealing to you.
This kind of fiction has such a strong sense of character. And the kind of things that we've just been talking about seem to be the kind of things that appear in science fiction. One of the most common critiques of science fiction as a genre is that it's not very strong in character development. It's often written for folks who just really like to see the technology, you know, and that's totally fine. But would you call this book, Blood, science fiction?
Some of the stories in it are aspiring science fiction. I've been a science fiction reader most of my life, so I have a great sense of what science fiction is and can do and really respect that. And I think I'm generally not much of a science fiction writer. Even the story that's most science fictional, Expositions, by the end sort of falls apart in its science fictionality. Because a lot of science fiction is about a particular ideas and speculations about technology. And I'm not really all that interested in speculations about technology. I like other people's, but I don't feel like that's where my brain goes. So I probably draw on the motifs and themes of science fiction a lot simply because I've read tons and tons and tons of it. But it's not where my mind as a fiction writer necessarily goes. That said, there are all sorts of different types of science fiction out there. And one of the things as a kid that I used to do is get into arguments with an English teacher at Plymouth State who declared to me that science fiction was formula fiction. And this was the thing I most deeply loved in the world. I was a subscriber to Isaac Asimov's magazine and all sorts of things. I was just reading it all the time and just loved it. And I wanted everybody else to love it too, and he didn't, and he frowned on it. And so I spent a lot of time thinking through, how can I prove to somebody that science fiction actually has merit? And that's affected actually a lot of my life. Since then, I became very interested in the work of Samuel R. Delaney, who's a science fiction writer but also a literary theorist. And I did my master's degree on him. He's part of my PhD dissertation. And so that whole question back to when I was, I think, 12 years old of, does science fiction have literary merit? Is it formula fiction? Has haunted me for my whole life. And it's still something I'm always thinking about, because it goes back to the question of, what is fiction? What can it be? What should it do? And those are the kinds of questions that not only fuel me as an intellectual, but also as a writer. Because as a writer, you're trying to create forms and shapes that can do new things in your reader's mind.
So what should fiction do?
That's a great question. I'm always asking myself that. I think that fiction should give us new ways of experiencing our lives. It puts something into our minds. It gives us imagined scenarios. It lets us see our way through a world that we didn't otherwise know. And so as a fiction writer, we have this ability to create these worlds through language. And so I think that the responsibility we have as fiction writers is both to the worlds and to the language, ideally. I'm sort of speaking utopianly here. What we all aim for is taking these worlds created out of language and putting them in some way in other people's minds to see what will happen.
Sounds like you've wanted to be a writer for a very long time, especially if you're discussing the art of fiction as a 12-year-old with a university professor.
Yes, I was a weird, geeky little kid. It was lucky I lived in a university town and my mother worked at the college.
You grew up in Plymouth.
I did. I've lived in Plymouth for all but a few years of my life. And so, yes, I was the Lamson Library at Plymouth State College, now Plymouth State University, was really where I learned to read. And so it was something I wanted to do from very early on. First, I wanted to be an FBI agent. Then I think I wanted to be a painter. And then I wanted to be a writer and pretty much stuck with that.
So pretty much you went through the same transition that all children go through.
Yes, in some way or
from
another.
From FBI to painter to writer,
of course. What I liked about the FBI is they carry a briefcase. I really wanted to carry a briefcase.
What's stopping you now?
Well, nothing. You know, writers get to carry briefcases too. And once I figured that out, it was much easier.
Where do you find your inspiration these days?
I think that I find inspiration both from reading other people's writing and from looking out at the world. It's very easy, especially if you're a writer like me who's read so much and thought so much about texts, it's very easy to get stuck inside of the words. And so I do my best to look out at the world and see what's happening and stay friends with people who are not writers or academics or things like that. So, and always challenging myself then to think about not just what do I want to write, but what do I want to write and then give someone to read? Because I think that's a different responsibility. I do like to write for myself, but then I'm taking this stuff and asking people to publish it, having it come out in a book, asking people to pay money for it. So if you're going to do that, you have to think about what do you feel is worth other people's time.
And I imagine if you follow the news, you'll find no shortage of things that would inspire the kind of apocalyptic fiction that you've been writing.
Yes, it's terrifying. I've actually pulled back on my news consumption these days because it can just you can reach a point of hopelessness if you really start thinking about all of the challenges of the world.
You feel like you've almost reached that point?
Oh, no. No, I push against it as much as I can. Because also, I read a lot of history and study a lot of history. And one of the things is that the world is always ending. The world has always been ending. I think people always felt like they were on the precipice of apocalypse throughout history. And so I take a little bit of comfort from that, is that we're not the first people who thought that we were the last people.
And I hear you grew up in a gun shop in New Hampshire.
I did indeed. Quite literally, the shop was attached to the house that I grew up in. And so my father was a sort of stay-at-home work dad. And so when I was a little kid, he would, you know, be working in the shop and then come take care of me. And he did that for about 40 years until his death. And I never paid a lot of attention to it growing up. It just was there. It wasn't something that really interested me. And so when he died suddenly, and I'm an only son. My parents are divorced. I inherited a gun shop about which I knew almost nothing. So I had to learn a lot about the gun industry in for it took about 2 years to sell it all off.
Well, you must have learned something about the guns because, I mean, they appear in the story. In fact, there's one story in here where there's a father who is a gun repairman, and he goes kind of crazy. I hope that didn't happen in your family. But
no, it didn't.
Okay. But yes. He goes crazy and sort of starts thinking that the government's out to get him, and many shots were fired in the story. I don't want to give it away, but seems like you found some inspiration in that.
Yes. The title story of the book, Blood, is all about a very heightened sort of version of my growing up. I'm an only child. There are like four or five children in that family. It's a very different circumstance, but the sense of paranoia that comes with it, living in a gun shop will breed a great amount of paranoia in you.
Really?
I remember telling babysitters when they would come, the first thing I would do if they were new was show them where you could hide in the house without being seen through any of the windows.
Huh.
Just because, and I just inherited this paranoia that comes with that kind of business when it's attached to your house. And I think that the title story is really an attempt to write through that and write out of that and find a way through it.
Do you own a gun now?
I don't. I got rid of all of them, except for I have an old Civil War rifle that's about 7 feet long, and you would never want to shoot it because it might blow up.
Okay. Well, Matthew Cheney, thank you very much for coming in and talking about your collection of stories.
Great. Thank you so much.
That's Matthew Cheney. He's the author of the debut collection of stories, Blood, which won the Black Lawrence Hudson Prize. And Cheney will be reading from his work at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Saturday, May 28th at 4 o'clock. And you can find a list of the top five books on Matthew Cheney's bookshelf at nhpr.org. By the way, this episode right here makes 1 year of this bookshelf series, and there's no shortage of authors from or writing about New Hampshire. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing these interviews and sending in your reading recommendations. You can find more conversations with authors at our website, nhpr.org, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search for The Bookshelf from NHPR in the iTunes store. And yes, about those recommendations, send them to us by email. Our address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at NHPR Bookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.